Fans are going wild, and I'm so excited.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 136 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, as part of, well, a Be Fair to Hulk campaign. I know the phrase is actually Be Fair to Flair, but in this case, I'm going to be fair to Hulk Hogan because on my last episode, which covered WWF wrestlers on the Arsenio Hall show, which I'm definitely going to be doing more of, Hulk Hogan did not come off in the greatest light in the summer of 1991 talking about the subject of steroids, so to be fair to him, and with him being a childhood hero and all, I'm going to go back to one of the highest moments of his career. It's got nothing to do with marijuana or any other illegal narcotic, although some of them may have been involved, who knows. January 28th, 1984 edition of Championship Wrestling, which shows the match between he and the Iron Sheik from Madison Square Garden the previous Monday on the 23rd, where Hogan wins the WWF world title for the very first time. Something that, well, kind of just propels him to the stratosphere, changes wrestling forever. I mean, it's really no big deal. I always look for some kind of hook to these shows, and this one is pretty easy, but there's a lot more going on this episode of Championship Wrestling. But before I get into all that, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, where you can find other shows like Strong Style Story, which came out the other day, talking about the Young Lions Cup in New Japan Pro Wrestling. We also have WorldCast, covering World Class Championship Wrestling from 1983, and the great legendary feud going on in the fall of that year. Oh, you think it's Freebirds Von Erichs? No, that was kind of, I don't want to say it was effed out at that point, but Jimmy Garvin versus Chris Adams, that's going to be where it's at going forward from that point. The Days of Thunder podcast, which is not the Daves of Thunder podcast. I always have to be careful because that's one of my favorite comedy podcasts, Daves of Thunder, which apparently I thought it had gone away and I was saving the last episode because I was feeling wistful about it. And as it turns out, they released a new episode while I was in Alaska. So now I can go ahead and actually listen to those again. And yes, I'm going to get in a lot of Alaska talk right off the top because it's a place I never thought I would be able to go. And I was able to visit there last week from the 21st to the 27th. My wife was up there for work. The beauty of that is that all I have to do is pay for my flights to get there, which, you know, I'll admit was not exactly cheap to fly to Alaska. But in my head, I just had it like, oh, I can actually pay the extra $50 and get a seat with more legroom because, well, I'm not paying for a hotel room. And it's a hell of a long flight from Boston to Seattle. And then Seattle, there's kind of hopper planes that go up to Anchorage because we had two stops in, well, Sitka, Alaska was the first stop before we went to Anchorage later on. And in Sitka, it's kind of a small fishing village. I think it's like the fourth or fifth biggest city in Alaska by population. And there's about 8,000 people there. So that kind of tells you where everything's coming from. I think about half of the population of Alaska, or a little bit less than half, live in Anchorage or in the Anchorage area. going into Sitka, kind of a weird thing where the plane from Seattle was on the runway for takeoff, and I was kind of half asleep, and then all of a sudden it just kind of stopped, and I was like, did I just hallucinate that? No, they aborted the takeoff, and the pilot said something like, oh yeah, the check engine light came on. And I'm like, are you kidding me? What are we, flying around in my parents' 1983 Ford LTD station wagon? The check engine light came on? So we go back to the gate, and we're sitting there for over an hour, and I'm wondering, well, I text my wife, who's further back in the plane, and I said, they're going to make us change planes. 30 seconds later, the pilot comes on. Oh, yeah, everything's all set now. I'm like, okay, great. We're going to be on the same plane that aborted a takeoff. But everything was fine. We only ended up getting in an hour late. And Sitka, like I said, it's so small. It's like almost like a fishing village. You walk around the waterfront. Everything is walkable there. But we had a rental car anyway. A lot of dive bar. Well, three dive bars serving a population that, you know, isn't particularly substantial. And there were a couple of interesting things. Number one, they have a brewery there called Baranoff Brewing, which has to be the most obscure place I've ever been to in my life. And there's a thing in Alaska where they can only serve you 36 ounces every time you come in there. I don't understand why that is, but it's on all the walls there. So you figure, okay, you can have three 12-ounce beers, or if you're doing 4-ounce samples, you can have like 9 of them. But you can't have more than 36 ounces. Well, apparently that's all for show. I'll just say that, because when the inspector flies into Sitka, he's going to hit all the places at once, and apparently when one gets hit, the others are alerted and are tipped off. So also in Sitka is a golf course, and I played golf on a regulation course, yes, in Sitka, Alaska, for the first time in 16 years. And I got a 14 on the first hole because I lost 3 balls. Which I started to run out of golf balls because this course was particularly hilly, particularly adventurous. The ninth hole, I get up. I have no idea where I'm supposed to hit my shot. I have no idea where the green is. There's all bushes and shrubbery in me. It's a situation where I actually needed to use Google Satellite, like Google Maps on my phone, in order to see where I'm supposed to hit the ball. The problem with that is it's so remote, I'm not getting any kind of signal, so I really can't utilize that on my phone. So I just kind of said, I'm going to try to hit it over there and hope everything's for the best. And I used a yellow ball so that I could identify it. And sure enough, that was actually a hole where I did not lose a ball. But it was great fun. It was very hilly. And on the golf cart, they had instructions for how to navigate the hills, which kind of had me a little bit unnerved because I'm the only person out on the course. There's not a lot of people playing golf in Alaska on September 23rd. So I thought to myself, if this thing tips over on a hill and I end up pinned underneath this, this could be the end for me. This could be the 18th hole of life for me. I die in Sitka, Alaska, pinned under a golf cart. What a way to go that would be. But I got a little bit better. I don't think I lost a ball in the last 3 or 4 holes. I was very, very proud of myself. And in those aforementioned dive bars, I should mention that there's I don't know if this is something only in Sitka or if it's in other places in Alaska. They have these shots called duck farts. Now, it's kind of a crude name, and it is certainly a crude beverage because it is 1/3 Crown Royal, 1/3 Bailey's, and 1/3 Kahlua. Not exactly the ideal mix of those particular drinks, but I threw it back, and I was perfectly fine. I was not, you know, too hungover the next day. Of course, we went and ate a bunch of sushi at a place called Little Tokyo. But in Sitka, the place to go to, my favorite place there, is something called Fortress of the Bear, which is kind of this bear sanctuary where there are 4 full-grown brown bears, and then there are 2 cubs who just kind of made cameo appearances, almost like the midget wrestlers or whatever would do back in the day. And then there was like a black bear hanging out on like a tree branch on the outside, kind of like Sting in 1997 WCW. Like, I didn't know what was going to happen. Was he going to like come in on a zip line and we were going to have the black bears versus the brown bears? Didn't turn out that way because the brown bears were actually fighting each other at a certain point. I should post that to my Twitter because it was particularly interesting because we're on a deck overlooking these two giant circles where the Bears had their sanctuary. There was a bald eagle who was pretty badass that kind of flew in. I was hoping the Eagles were playing the Bears that weekend, but no, they were actually playing the Packers, I think it was. Then it was on midweek to Anchorage, Alaska, the big city, and we were not quite downtown, but it was easy enough to get down there. One brewery that I really love, 49th State Brewing. Food and beer. I always love the places that, yes, they can brew their own beer, and that's fine. But if they serve good food as well, I had halibut there, and then I had a kind of grilled cheese sandwich with crab. Oh, I loved it so much. And the other thing about Anchorage, and I know I'm going long on this, but you know how many chances do you get to go to Alaska? When you're walking around downtown Anchorage, you're just walking down the street, and you look straight ahead, and you see these huge snow-capped mountains to the east of downtown. And it's really an incredible sight. And if you go to, like, the western part of downtown, there's an overlook where, on a clear day, which it was last Thursday, you can see Denali, which the white people call Mount McKinley. But you can see it even though it's 110 miles away, the largest peak in North America. In terms of the temperatures, it was not that cold while we were there. It rained a lot when we were in Sitka, and a particularly bad rainstorm on Wednesday in Anchorage, but it never dropped during the day below the mid-40s. Usually it would be about 48 to 52 degrees during the day, which to me is fine. You just wear a hoodie, which I wish I had packed more than two of them because, you know, it was perfect to wear in that type of weather. Did go to a place, it's kind of a resort called Alyeska, which I guess is called Mount Alyeska, and it's a ski resort in the winter, which apparently is all double black diamond trails pretty much, because I'm looking around, I hadn't skied in years, but I'm looking around at how the ski trails would have looked. I'm like, I don't think I could have hacked this even on my best day. And that was probably the coldest place because you had a little tram gondola thing that would take you up about 2,800 feet, and you could actually see snow on the ground there. It did not snow or anything while we were there, but there, when you would go out to your car in the morning, you would have to scrape ice off the windshield, which I noticed when I was sitting in the hot tub in the hotel, which was very nice, and being able to look outside, seeing people scraping their windshields and seeing this as the sun is rising. I felt really good and really at peace, and also feeling particularly badass because my former employer of 10 years called me and wanted to gauge my interest in coming back. But they're a little late on that because I started a new job a couple of days ago, or at least I hope so. I'm taping this on a Monday morning, which is the last day of my unemployment. So this week is kind of a big change in my life in terms of I'm starting a new job and I'm going into, you know, a somewhat different, it's still financial field, but it's a little bit different than, you know, the custodial banks that I was working in. So now I figure, well, why don't I just do like a big change in wrestling, such as Hulk Hogan winning the WWF title for the first time. And it doesn't get much bigger than this. Trivia for Greetings from Allentown is when I did a test show before I recorded the first podcast, I actually did this show. I recorded about 10 minutes just to kind of see how it would go. And I wasn't exactly pleased because I was doing more of a watch-along format instead of the take notes and then comment on it later. So Hogan winning the title sets the stage for everything that's going to happen in 1984 for the WWF, the national expansion. And as I said, the match is on this show, and it's right off the bat. It is the first thing. However, it is not the only big thing that happens on this show, because we see the final edition of Victory Corner, the interview segment on WWF programming that lasted from about October, November of 83 to now. So not very long. And you could also say that this is the first Piper's Pit and the last Victory Corner at the same time, because it's on the Piper's Pit set, but it's hosted by the guy from Victory Corner. So it is a little confusing because it says, okay, it's Victory Corner. Piper's Pit starts up the next week. We also get a return of a guy who was big in the WWF a couple of years before this in Greg Valentine, returning from Jim Crockett Promotions. Well, sort of. I'm going to get into that when I get to his match, because he had a very kind of unusual thing going on in the first quarter of 1984. So you got players coming in, big-time dudes. And, oh, yeah, this is also the debut of B. Brian Blair as well. Yeah, I really can't wait to talk about that. But to get into this taping in Allentown, Pennsylvania, taped January 24th, 1984. So they did not waste any time. The Madison Square Garden show is on Monday the 23rd. They taped the next day in Allentown, and then the day after that in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. So this is literally the day after. And on this taping, there are a couple of interesting things that go on of note. And I could save this for a point where I would cover these other shows, but I like to spread this out, so I'm just going to throw it out there right now. On this taping, we get an Andre the Giant interview for All American Wrestling, where he says that he's not going to challenge Hulk Hogan for the WWF title and that he is just happy being the Giant. That's something that I think has been replayed on Andre documentaries, and that is actually done on this taping. There's also an instance where Mr. Fuji refused to work a match, in a tag team match against Andre the Giant and Tito Santana. And why is that? Well, he didn't want to tag without his regular tag team partner. I'm going to get into that towards the end of the show, because they actually promote that match as happening and something else ends up going off the following week's show. We also see, which also occurs on the following week's show, February 4th, and then the week after as well, February 11th, a confrontation in the aisle between the Iron Sheik, the former WWF champion, and Sergeant Slaughter. So we're wasting no time moving the Sheik onto something else. And Sergeant Slaughter, who had lost his manager, Grand Wizard, the previous fall, passed away. Slaughter just kind of floats around as a manager-less heel towards the end of 1983 and into 1984, has this confrontation with the Iron Sheik, which is natural because you have the Marine Drill Sergeant, even though he's a heel, against the evil Iranian. So it's a natural feud to sort of set up. And they do that thing where they end up meeting in the aisle, where Sheik is coming back from his match, Slaughter is coming down to the ring for his match, and they meet in the aisle and just kind of have a confrontation there. The match between the two of them does not take place until the next taping and airs on the February 18th edition of Championship Wrestling. We also get, on this taping, the in-ring debut of Rowdy Roddy Piper, so it's not just the first Piper's Pit. He does not actually wrestle until the February 11th show, so I guess later in the taping, we put it. He's tagging with Dr. D. David Schultz, something that would not last very long. The idea is to give him a little bit of a respite from some of his injuries in Jim Crockett Promotions, the famous chain match with Greg Valentine at Starrcade 83, where he lost 50% of the hearing in his ear or something like that. So a little bit banged up. Give him some time as a manager. Establish him as a heel. Establish Piper's Pit as this platform that's going to basically send him to new heights. So with all that in mind, why don't we just get right into it for WWF Championship Wrestling for January 28th, 1984. It's one hell of a coincidence that Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun reached the top 40 for the first time on this week in 1984, landing at number 31. I would have guessed anything that one of her songs would have reached number one at some point in 1984, but a lot of competition going on at that point, so she only quite got up to, I think, number two with Girls Just Want to Have Fun, and later, the Girls Just Want to Have Fun version from 1994 apparently reached number four as well. Time after time, only got to number three because you had so many other artists like Michael Jackson, Huey Lewis. They're kind of blocking the way to number one. It was very tough sledding. So even though Hulk Hogan is the new champion and you're going to see him in the intro going forward starting in March, we still have the kind of boring intro with the drop kick from the Eddie Gilbert, Bob Backlund guy, who I can't figure out who it is, against Tiger Chung Lee, because I can't find any record of when that match would have happened on TV. Andre with the big boot, Rocky Johnson with the drop kick and sunset flip, and then the weird edit with Superfly Snuka coming off the top rope, where he's definitely going to hit the headbutt, so they pause it in midair, and then they show him coming from the other side and hitting the splash on a completely different person, and then wrapping with Bob Backlund being congratulated with the world title in the ring, which kind of a odd thing for about 5 weeks, where the guy who's no longer the champion is being celebrated as such in the opening to the show. And our hosts are Vince McMahon, of course, because he's on every freaking program at this point. He didn't trust Gorilla to do commentary on weekly TV, not quite yet. And Mean Gene Okerlund on color, who was not very good in that role. I've said that many times. He's just kind of yelling like Dick Graham quite a lot. Like, whoa, when somebody would hit a big move. But the funny thing about this, and I'm not sure why I should even have a problem with them doing this, but they spoiled the world title change right off the bat, which I guess is to hook the audience in.
And this week, Mean Gene, all kinds of excitement here.
I don't mind telling you, of course, the big news, the new world's heavyweight champion in the incredible Hulk Hogan. And what a night it was at Madison Square Garden, Monday, January the 23rd. We're going to be hearing about that for a long, long time to come.
Yes, we're going to see the match at Madison Square Garden, but they also have to tell us about the other things coming up on the show, like the return of Greg Valentine. And as I said, B. Brian Blair debuts on this show. I think I find this funny for a lot of different reasons, the way that Gene Okerlund kind of screws it up.
Also scheduled to join us, the Hammer, Greg Valentine.
Greg Valentine returning to the World Wrestling Federation. Also, Paul Blair and a lot more coming up. It's going to be a very exciting hour.
Now, I know that Mean Gene meant to say Paul Orndorff and Brian Blair, but just kind of conflated that into Paul Blair, former Orioles outfielder from the early 70s. I mean, his baseball career was over, but so if he wanted to give wrestling a try, I don't know. I'm not sure that this would be the best fit for him. Maybe he could work some other territories first before coming up to New York. Although he did finish his career with the Yankees, so it would be kind of a natural crossover. They would actually, the audience might know him. Who knows? And we do go right to Madison Square Garden with the Hulk Hogan entrance. It just gives me chills, not just because, oh, I'm a childhood hero, like I said earlier, but you see it so many times for years to come. And this match is so integral, not only to the company going forward, but because everything from this match is going to be in the signature at the top of the show for the next 2.5 years, all the way to September of 1986. Hogan's walk to the ring, Sheik and Blassie looking very concerned, stuff going on in the match, Hogan raising the belt afterwards. So you get one shot to get it right, and you want to make sure you hit all your spots. But the way Hogan, they show him coming out down the alleyway, kind of like Goldberg you would see with him a decade and a half later. Eye of the Tiger hits, Hogan starts making that walk, goes down the hallway. Vince McMahon Sr. is on one side. Hogan just walks right past him. And Vince Sr. let him go in 1981, apparently because he wasn't happy that Hogan wanted to appear in Rocky as Thunderlips, which propelled him to a greater level of fame. And without that, he's not at this point. So there's something very fitting about him just walking past Vince McMahon Sr., who's at the gorilla position, I guess, although Gorilla is actually on commentary for this with Pat Patterson, kind of the odd team for Madison Square Garden for 83 and into 1984. You wonder, why isn't Vince McMahon doing the MSG show? So he stopped doing it in around January of 83. And there's a lot of intrigue going on in this night. Vince probably wanted to be in the back anyway. And the story out there now was, oh, Iron Sheik was going to be paid by Vern Gagne to break Hulk Hogan's legs in this match. And Sheiky went ahead and did business. He did the right thing. And the reason why it was the right thing is because if he had done that, he wouldn't have gotten insane loyalty from Vince McMahon for years forward, despite all of his various legal issues. Iron Sheik kept getting brought back in for whatever reason, and I think a lot of it goes back to him doing business here. So the entrance is very cinematic, which is done on purpose, because they're going to use this at for just about everything going forward. The lead-up for Hogan, and I covered him appearing on Wrestling at the Chase, which was his first match back in the WWF, which they taped in December of 83 in St. Louis. He only did a few TV matches. Like, you did the tag with Backlund in Allentown. You had a couple of singles matches in St. Louis. He was not doing any house shows until you get to this MSG match. And then once it's over, he actually goes right to Japan for some New Japan shows. But as crazy as that sounds, where he wins the title and then immediately goes to Japan, But unlike what he would do in 1993, he's not going to give an interview saying, well, this belt here is just a stepping stone. I really want the IWGP title. Here, he goes to Japan, and these are some of my favorite Hulk Hogan results of all time, because he wins the title on the 23rd, and on the 27th in Nagoya, Japan, he is teaming with Iron Mike Sharp, and they fought Antonio Inoki and Tatsumi Fujinami to a double countout. Hulk Hogan, Antonio Inoki, Tatsumi Fujinami, and Iron Mike Sharp all in the same match. Those are the four guys. I absolutely love that friggin' result. And then the next day, actually on the day that this would have aired, on the 28th, a couple of interesting results. Hulk Hogan and Iron Mike Sharp, apparently that's the hot tag team in Japan, defeated Riki Choshu and Yoshiaki Yatsu when Hogan pinned Yatsu. Well, I didn't think Iron Mike Sharp was getting the pin. The main event of that show, or at least the last match listed, Antonio Inoki, Tatsumi Fujinami, and Kengo Kimura defeated Rusher Kimura, Bad News Allen, and Bret Hart when Inoki pinned Bret, because Bad News sure as hell wasn't taking the pin. And I finally got in my Bad News reference for this week, some 25 minutes into the show.
This is the main event. It is for the World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Championship, scheduled for one fall with a one-hour time limit. Introducing first the challenger from Venice Beach, California,
so many things I love about the old MSG shows, such as how the microphone comes down from the ceiling and it says MSG on it, Howard Finkel's classic announcements, but especially that dude who just keeps ringing the bell as if he's calling for quiet. That just cracks me. Ding, 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 like every 5 seconds. It's so great. It's like the timekeeper is telling everybody to shut up. It's like the weird cousin of when you have the run-in after the match and the timekeeper just keeps ringing the bell like every 30 seconds to try and get them to stop, and it just never works. It's so good. Oh, so Hogan is referred to as the Incredible Hulk Hogan, which is an upgrade from the Fabulous Hulk Hogan that he was as a heel from 79 to 81 in the WWF. But the problem with the Incredible Hulk Hogan is the phrase Incredible Hulk, because every time you use that, you gotta cut whoever it is, Marvel. I'm not a comics guy, so I don't know, but you gotta cut them a check every time you use the name, which is part of the reason why when Hogan turns heel at WCW, he goes by Hollywood Hogan a lot more and kind of drops the Hulk in hopes that you never have to cut that check anymore in the future. The Incredible kind of gets dropped later in 1984, but using the word Hulk, you still have to, you know, license that out. So as the bell rings, the funny thing is, the Iron Sheik turns his back and he's trying to get his robe off, but Hogan attacks immediately, elbow in the corner, and then Hogan grabs the robe of the Sheik, whips him into the ropes, and clotheslines him with his own robe. Then, with Sheik on the mat, starts choking him. It's like, who's the heel in this match? Oh, wait, the guy with the Iranian flag, of course. And you're allowed to do whatever you want. Running clothesline and a knee drop by Hogan. That's not a move that I would see him bring out on a regular basis. And another iconic moment from this match where he lifts Sheik up for the two-handed choke and throws him to the mat and then kind of spits on him. Which not particularly hygienic. I'm not sure how clean that ring was for January 23rd. Another interesting point about this match is this didn't go on last. Yes, it's announced as the main event of the evening, and often the main event would be at the midpoint of the show so that you could say, oh, the rematch is going to be next month, and then you can go and buy tickets for that sort of thing. Well, the last match on this show, which is not exactly the most exciting house show, I believe the full thing is on the WWE Network, but there is a lot of, like, Jose Luis Rivera stuff early on. I mean, the fact that this crowd of 26,292, which includes 4,000 at the Felt Forum, sat through Tony Garea versus Jose Luis Rivera, the Invaders versus Fuji and Tiger Chung Lee, and several other matches. But what went on last, to get back to my original point, Andre the Giant, Rocky Johnson, and Tony Atlas defeated Afa, Sika, and Samoa, so the three Wild Samoans, when Andre pinned Samoa at 5:29. So that match is actually shorter than what this one ends up being. So Sheik is just being dominated. I just remember this being a total squash, with the exception of the little bit of offense that Sheik gets in, although there was more of it than what I remembered. Big boot, and he goes for the cover, and the referee, Dick Lux, I forget how to pronounce his name, but I think it's the guy who used to do the pregame show on WRKO for the Red Sox, or was that Dick Lutz? I don't even know. So Irish Whip hits the elbow, and then a forearm. I thought he was going to go for the Axe Bomber there, Hogan, but that only gets a two count. The referee was out of position on the earlier count, which is why Hogan only got one. So a cross-corner whip, Hogan charges in, but he ends up missing. It's not a spot you'd see in a lot of Hogan matches, so it's very different. So now Sheik takes the opportunity to start working the back, because Hogan went back first on that charge. And this place is friggin' loud, as Sheik scores with a backbreaker, goes for a pin, but Hogan with the big, emphatic kick out. As the referee is kind of facing away, facing Hulk Hogan, who's down on the mat, the Iron Sheik then loads his boot, one of my favorite moves that he would do. And I say that because when I would do, like, matches with my LJN figures back in the day, you know, Iron Sheik was one of the ones that I have. I never had the Hogan LJN, so I had to kind of create, like, a mid-card universe led by, you know, Piper, JYD, Terry Funk, although those guys were kind of main eventers, especially Terry Funk and Piper. And he loads up the boot, and when I would use Iron Sheik, I would have him load the boot in literally every single match, because that's how it was on the old Coliseum videos. A kick to the kidney, and then a very strange double-leg takedown. Like, what is the Sheik going for here? Is he going to try to break his leg? But no, he goes for a Boston Crab, which, okay, I forget. How does Hogan get out of this? He actually just kind of pushes up and powers out of it, and the crowd is going bananas for it, because of the way he was just kind of able to get out of it with relative ease. So Sheik goes back to his bread and butter, a gut-wrench suplex, and goes to the pin, gets a two count, that not quite the emphatic kick out we saw a little bit earlier. And like I said, Sheik's getting a little bit more offense in this match, which runs 5 minutes and 40 seconds, than I remembered. Now, this part of the match is rather infamous, as Hogan on his stomach in the center of the ring, in perfect position for the camel clutch. Now, you say, okay, this is kind of an iconic moment, maybe partly for the camel clutch, but also for the Iron Sheik's noticeable boner. Now, he's wearing trunks here. He's not wearing the long tights, and his boner is, it stands out. It's basically casting a shadow. That is how much of a boner it happens to be. And I kind of blame the crowd for this. I mean, maybe it could be some sort of friction going on. Maybe he's just turned on by the crowd. But I think the lesson here is this: if you're a professional wrestler, or even if you're just an actor, and you're going out there for a huge crowd in the biggest moment of your career, be sure to rub one out beforehand. Just treat it like a third date with a woman that has potential. And the Iron Sheik locks in spite of his boner, the camel clutch, a callback to the Bob Backlund match 4 weeks earlier at Madison Square Garden. Nobody had gotten out of it, although he was still pretty much a short timer, at least in this run. He had been there as Hussein Arab in 79 and 80, not as the Iron Sheik. Comes back in very late 1983 and is kind of accelerated as a challenger to Backlund, does the Persian clubs thing, and that causes the injury to Backlund on All-Star just a little bit before this match. So nobody has gotten out of it, but Hulk Hogan, he's waving the finger as, like, kind of the arms are trapped up on Sheik's legs. I mean, this is such an iconic moment. He powers up out of it, sits up, somehow keeps Sheik on his back despite the boner kind of creating like that tripod effect, like the pole that you would put in the middle of a tent. I'm not much of a Boy Scout, but I feel like that might be a problem. But Hogan, no doubt feeling uncomfortable for this Iranian man's boner pointing directly into his back, rams him into the corner, and Sheiky hits hard, and probably because his dick might be broken now, he falls right in the center of the ring, and Hogan, realizing that this is his opportunity, runs across the ring, hits the running leg drop, the one, the two, and the three. As I had played it in the intro at the top of the show, Hogan gets the belt, holds it up, and all I can notice, and this is great iconic moment, and I'm just looking around for other stuff going on. Like, they cut to the unattractive woman clapping in the front row who would become a fixture on All-Star Wrestling Signature for the next 2.5 years. But also, within Madison Square Garden, I'm looking up the little scoreboard that you would have on the, you know, front facing of, like, the upper levels, I guess the 300 or 400s of MSG. There's an ad for Atari. Now, Atari had a pretty bad year in 1983. Now, there was a whole video game crash that year in the United States, so I don't think that Atari ad was going to last very long. I remember seeing Burger King up there a little bit later, although that may have been there at this point anyway. And then it goes up, the camera pans over, and it just says Knicks in big letters. Now, the Knicks were not completely terrible in 84. Something to be proud of. They took the Celtics to 7 games, although it was pretty much Bernard King taking 7 games. And the referee, this elderly man who couldn't get in position, gives Hogan the belt. Hogan's kind of falling around, staggering, holds it up, and they're going to put the belt on he's not going to do the full pose down, but they're going to actually put the belt on him. And, of course, the official is assisting him, and he screws it up by putting on the belt upside down, which I don't think Vince was throwing a nutty at this point, because everything else was pretty good up to that point. Sheiky is selling this like crazy. He's still laying in the center of the ring to the point where the ringside doctor kind of makes his way in, like, hey, dude, are you all right here? What's going on? Like, oh, my dick, it broken. It's all Brian Blair fault. Okay, that may be a bad Iron Sheik, but maybe that's why he was down in the center of the ring. Maybe he wasn't selling. Maybe he had something wrong with his junk. And being a guy, I can't say that I blame him for it. But yes, me covering one of the most iconic moments in the history of the World Wrestling Federation and in pro wrestling in general has just devolved into a series of dick jokes. So why don't we move on? The goofy Hulk Hogan stuff that has occurred in the 35 plus years since that moment, it still gives me chills. It still hits me. It provides some sort of emotion, whether I'm watching it on an airplane, I'm watching it in my living room, or if I'm watching it out at sea, which would be a little bit weird if I was watching wrestling out on a, I guess maybe on a ferry to Long Island, something to that effect. So everything has changed now, but oh, wait a minute, we're going to go back in time, because we go back to Allentown and Agricultural Hall, and here's Joe McHugh. It's like we literally went back in a time warp, and Joe McHugh is there, and he's going to introduce everything, but sadly, even though this is the first show of the taping, we don't get the full Joe McHugh introduction.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Championship Wrestling. My name is Joe McHugh, your ring announcer.
God bless Joe McHugh. I will never get tired of him introducing himself. In fact, I should probably do the same thing on the podcast every week, because I always do the same intro, like, hello and welcome. You know, I'm your host, Peter Winston, and my name is Peter Winston. Something like that. Maybe if I could roll the R's like Joe McHugh, which apparently I can't. So coming up next, we have Bill Dixon of Steubenville, Ohio, where, yes, I once took the bus to Steubenville late on a Tuesday night from Boston. It took about 19 hours, and I'm never going to do that again. He's facing off against Tito Santana. Dixon, best known for being Hulk Hogan's first match back in that aforementioned St. Louis taping in December of 83. Tito Santana, he is definitely on the way up. He had returned late in 83 and went to the AWA. I think he might have been in Georgia for a bit, but he was a tag team champion with Ivan Putski back in 79 and 80. Not much is made of their association this time around, but certainly on the Intercontinental title track, and he would go and win that title in the Boston Garden in February of 84 from Don Morocco in a match which I don't think the entire thing exists on tape. They were not taping the Boston Garden shows for New England Sports Network at that point. They did show a clip of it on the weekly TV, but I don't think I've seen anything further than that. So Tito, it's interesting because you had Hulk Hogan winning the title in January, and you think, okay, you might want to have the, now that you have a face world champion, you probably want to have a heel Intercontinental champion. But instead, they go the other way with Tito, the ultimate babyface, who was never a heel in his entire career. And my thought on this was, is he the best face Intercontinental champion of the 1980s? And in kind of just looking at it, title didn't change hands that often during the decade. And in fact, there are only five possible choices for babyface Intercontinental champions in the decade. And Pat Patterson is the first quarter of 1980, and that really doesn't count because it was just not enough months. Ricky Steamboat, kind of the same thing. You got him March of 87 through the beginning of June of 87. So that's 2.5 months. That's even less than Patterson, which leaves you with Pedro Morales, Tito Santana, and the Ultimate Warrior. Tito is the only one who was never actually the world champion out of those three. But in terms of the quality of the title reign, and Tito having two reigns, Warrior having two reigns, and Morales also having two reigns, I'm going to go with Tito because there's not really a whole lot memorable about the Pedro Morales reign in 82 and before that. He won it late in 80 and kind of played back and forth with Morocco over the next couple of years. The Ultimate Warrior, it seemed to be that it accomplished the goal of elevating him to that world title level. Now, he didn't draw money like a world champion, but it got him to the point where, yes, you can have this match at WrestleMania 6. However, I'm not looking at it from this perspective. I'm looking at it from how much I enjoyed them as champion. Tito was kind of the fighting champion for much of the summer of 84 and into the fall, loses it to Valentine, and then has that long chase before finally regaining in the summer of 85 in that cage match in Baltimore. And then his main challenger going forward is the Macho Man Randy Savage, and who finally wins it in February of 86, also in the Boston Garden. Nice little tie back, having Tito lose the title in the exact same place that he had won it. So as this thing gets underway, you think about everything that's going to happen with the national expansion of the World Wrestling Federation as we go through the year 1984. But hey, we're still in January here, and in the Howard Finkel promo that kind of goes over the first 40 seconds of this match. And Finkel sometimes would struggle with these, but what's more fascinating to me is the type of venues that he's talking about at this point in time.
This is a commercial break. Great wrestling action on Long Island this Tuesday night, January 31st at the West Islip High School Gym. A fabulous card topping it all. Jimmy Superfly Snuka, West Islip High School this Tuesday. And on Thursday, February 2nd, at the Comac Long Island North High School Gym. Among those signed to appear include the Mighty Midgets, Chief J. Strongbow, and the Wild Samoan.
Think of the track that Vince McMahon has this company on with the national expansion, but yet, still at this point, you're playing the West Islip High School Gym, which is over an hour train ride from New York City. So this isn't like Long Island, you know, close to, you know, Queens or Brooklyn or anything like that. It's a bit of a ways out there. I was there earlier this year. And in fact, Jimmy Snuka was not on that card, at least according to Graham Koth on site, thehistoryofwwe.com. And just for, you know, whatever, here's the card. The Invaders defeated Bob Radley and Rene Goulet. Chief J. Strongbow defeated Sika by DQ. SD Jones fought the Tonga Kid to a draw. Wild Samoans fought Tony Garea and Jose Luis Rivera to a double countout. Bob Backlund defeated Mr. Fuji. Yes, Bob Backlund was headlining on this show, and the Tonga Kid won a battle royal. So can you imagine going to the West Islip High School gym on the 31st? Bob Backlund is there like, hey, weren't you too injured to do the match at Madison Square Garden a week ago? But, you know, he had to be pushed aside somehow, and pushed aside he was. Dixon, in this match against Tito Santana, gets in a surprising amount of offense for a guy who you're pushing to the Intercontinental title. Very forearm-based, I have to say. It's not like he has a lot of diversified stuff. It's not like the Iron Sheik can throw a gut-wrench suplex or anything. And Tito quickly fires up, and I should note, he's wearing black trunks, an unusual look for Tito. Like I said, always a baby face. He's wearing black trunks in this era, which, you know, only heels wore black. And a backdrop, a drop kick, and then he hits the flying forearm, propelling himself off the ropes, running the ropes, that is. And then we get the fastest freaking three count of all time by Dick Worley, who, once again, if you're not familiar with him, and you are familiar with the TV show Cheers, now that I think about it, anybody who's not familiar with Cheers definitely wouldn't be familiar with Dick Worley. Anyway, he reminds me of the worst-case scenario of Coach from the first three seasons of Cheers. And yeah, Tito in black was just really, really strange, and I'm glad he did not wear this very often, which he must have felt the same way because he stuck with that white Strike Force stuff for years and years after Martel left him. He's always a babyface, and it's as it should be.
Picture the golden Florida vacation you've dreamed of. Then add the throbbing excitement of deepest Africa.
Suncoast Safari.
Florida's Pinellas Suncoast. Colorful resort communities and the Gulf beaches of Tampa Bay. And Busch Gardens, the dark continent Tampa. Exotic animals, thrilling rides, and dazzling shows. For your Florida vacation, see tomorrow's newspaper or next week's Sports Illustrated.
Come for it all.
That commercial for Tampa Bay Tourism actually aired the weekend before this during the Super Bowl, which was held at Tampa Stadium. No, not the one at WrestleMania 36 or whatever symbol, WrestleMania pirate flag. I haven't seen that they have a logo yet. But anyway, it kind of made me want to go to Tampa for whatever reason, although I don't think I'm going to make it to this year's WrestleMania for a variety of different reasons. But I do have SummerSlam to fall back on, which will be right here in Boston, and I almost certainly will be going to that. Just going to give you a heads up, though, TD Garden has been renovated, and I can tell you that the seats there are smaller than they were before. Yes, they renovated the building and made the seats smaller. Why? So that they could fit more seats and sell more tickets and make more money. So, really just kind of a sad situation. But up next, we have the former tag team champions, the Wild Samoans, three times former champions, facing off against the Enhancement Super Team. And rarely do you see these two guys together on the same side. Steve Lombardi and SD Jones. Yes, Lombardi as a babyface jobber. Previous to about summer of 84, by the end of the year, he's only facing heels. I think it must have been that time that Hulk Hogan came in to kind of give him comfort before a match against Kamala, and then Hogan never really backed him up later. Maybe that's what turned Lombardi to the dark side, for whatever that's worth. What needs to be talked about more when it comes to the Wild Samoans is Afa's facial hair is quite good. It doesn't get enough credit, I don't think. It is quite the Fu Manchu. And ordinarily, I wouldn't want to see him in a dark alley even if he didn't have facial hair. But him having that, it just kind of accentuates the entire thing as we get another Howard Finkel read at the beginning of it, this one for a couple of different shows. And also referring to the title change, Hulk Hogan winning the title. I don't know why he brought that up since he's immediately going to Japan to team up with Iron Mike Sharp. So Lombardi starts out with Afa, who locks on a short arm scissors and does some mat work. Actually, I'm just kidding. Afa was not doing any of that stuff. He just starts working the throat. And as he does that, Vince and Gene take a fan letter, because you could actually write into wrestling with the P.O. box and everything, and they would read these questions on the air. Now, I don't know how on the up and up and whether these are real people, but the question was, What are some other contending tag teams other than the Wild Samoans for the tag team titles, which is held by Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas? And Gene's reaction kind of shows how new to the company he is, because I don't think he knows.
Obviously, other than Apa and Sika, they, I would think, would be number one contenders for Atlas and Johnson. I don't know.
Well, they've got to be. But of course, there are so many combinations in the World Wrestling Federation. Vince McMahon, I could go on probably for the course of this entire program, but certainly many, many deserving teams that I'm certain will work their way up the ladder. And we're going to be seeing, I think, many different combinations. Action outside of the ring right now.
Oh, my.
Yes, so many tag teams. Just name one of them, please. It reminds me of that Brewster's Millions bit when he's talking about donating to charities. Like, the woman's like, oh, there's so many worthwhile charities. And he goes, so many worthwhile charities. Without actually naming one. Although, to be fair, the WWF tag team division wasn't all that great. I mean, who are you going to put in that spot? Because Adonis and Murdoch haven't arrived yet. I mean, it's basically Fuji and Tiger Chung Lee. And apparently, they don't want to refer to them as being contenders, because we must disrespect Tiger Chung Lee at all times. A Samoan drop by Afa, and then Lombardi ends up on the outside of the ring, and they just work him over good. They pick him up like it's going to be a body slam, but instead slam him into the ring post. Now, at this point, I wonder, SD Jones hasn't been in the match yet, and the referee's laying on the count, but he's not counting Lombardi out of the match, who is just helped to the back because he cannot continue. I'm like, okay, what is going on here? Like, I believe it's the same referee, Dick Worley, who did the fast count earlier, but whatever, who cares? So SD Jones comes back after helping Lombardi and nails the Samoans with a double noggin knocker, because SD's smart. He's been around the territory. He knows that to get the Samoans to sell something to the head, you have to hit them into each other. That was actually a real thing, where the Samoans would not sell for other guys. They would sell for each other on a move like that. So, hey, you know, whatever works. Rocky Johnson has actually joined SD for moral support, but Tony Atlas isn't there, at least yet anyway, so to help up or back up his tag team partner. Rocky ends up on the inside of the ring, but then he is quickly sent outside as the Samoans are just kind of dominating everybody that they come across. Now Tony Atlas is down, and the Samoans actually dominate him too, as the bell rings and the Samoans prevail by disqualification. So basically, they just can't be touched in this match for whatever reason. They beat down the existing tag team champions, who had defeated the Wild Samoans late in 1983 for the titles. SD and the Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas, they all help each other up and they walk out of there. But first, we got Atlas and Johnson doing an interview with Okerlund. And it's very interesting always when these two guys are together, because as I've explained many times, whenever it comes up, they did not care for each other at all. They were not friendly with each other. There was not any sort of camaraderie or chemistry between the two. And what I'm kind of, maybe I'm just hyper-analyzing what these guys are saying, but Rocky goes first, and I'm kind of wondering what he's talking about.
You brought us this, so let me say this. The war is just starting, brothers. That's what the Samoans want. If they want to get down, then we'll show you a whole new different Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas, brother, because I'm sick, I'm tired, I'm fed up with them guys, and I know my partner feels exactly the same way.
When he said I'm sick of those guys, I thought he was referring to Tony Atlas instead of the Samoans. But yeah, okay, I guess he's referring to the Samoans, and I'm just reading into everything based on what I know about those two guys. Now, Atlas, for his part, Rocky Johnson spoke for about 16 seconds, but Tony Atlas has decided to be a little bit more verbose and has decided to go into preacher Tony Atlas mode.
Well, all I got to say, and I hope that I don't have to say this no more, is the fact that if the Samoans want to get down and inflict the pain, if they want to get K-I-N-K-Y, there's nobody can get more down like that than I can at Rocky Johnson. Now, we are the champions for more. We got it if you like it or not. And there's one more thing that I am, brother, that you have forgotten. What I am, what Rocky is 50 stars on a baby blue background with 13 stripes what I am, brother. I am an American. I am white, black, gentleman, and every other nationality.
Listen to this crowd. The beginning, I was a little concerned with Tony Atlas, like, oh, we're gonna get kinky, like, oh, okay. Now, we know Tony Atlas had, like, that foot fetish thing back in the day. It tended to be with women, I would presume, but then you get the Samoans in there, these 300-pound dudes who do not wear boots, so they have exposed feet, but I'm not going to prejudge him for having an extreme foot fetish. I mean, you do whatever you want to do behind closed doors. But luckily, he brought it back around by turning it into a patriotic speech, although I was very confused when Tony started his sentence by saying, I am white! I'm like, oh, okay, do go on. That would have been a bad spot for, like, an inadvertent cough. Or like, I am white! Black! I am Asian, I am everything. Okay, yeah, you're Mr. USA, Tony Atlas. Just a little bit strange, but yeah, the chemistry not there between him and Rocky Johnson. And we now get more promos with Gene Okerlund standing by the ring, the way that Vince McMahon used to do it back in the day. But now, Vinnie Mac doesn't have time for that anymore. He's got to worry about business, so Gene Okerlund is there to pick up the slack. And we start with Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff and Rowdy Roddy Piper, who is his manager, at least for now. And Mr. Wonderful, he will be challenging Hulk Hogan for the world title, so he will get the first shot at him in Madison Square Garden, the same place where Hulk Hogan won that title. And I say, Orndorff does not particularly care for New York, which makes me wonder why he would have come to the territory.
You talk a lot just like everybody else around that New York. You know what I got a good mind to do? Get me a bunch of barbed wire, string it all the way around that city, and charge admission for the world's biggest zoo. That's what I think of it.
I was kind of holding my breath there, like, please, Orndorff, please don't say anything racist here. I don't need you to turn into John Rocker saying stuff about New York City. But when he talks about, I don't want to put barbed wire, I thought he was talking about putting barbed wire around the ring. I'm like, what is he, some sort of, like, time traveler from FMW in the mid-90s, like, working the deathmatch circuit? Didn't really strike me as that kind of guy, Mr. Wonderful. But no, he wants to, the old joke that I used to have about Somerville, Massachusetts, they should just throw up a fence around it and give everybody 5 to 10. But hey, but that's not all he has to say. He's going to escalate this in a way that would be verboten on WWF television going forward.
Mr. Wonderful showed right out there in front of everybody why I'm so great, why I am the best looking, why I have the greatest body in professional wrestling today.
Give me
look at Hulk Hogan. He's a big dummy. He's losing his hair. He bleaches it. He does this, he does that. He's the new champion, right? Well, he's not going to be the champion for long.
Let me tell you something.
I'm not sure I've heard any other references to Hulk Hogan going bald on WWF television. I mean, this is very early in his run, and they probably told him to knock that shit off going forward because, wow. I mean, that's something that you just would not hear. But going, and then Gene Okerlund kind of screws up, like, he will not be the champion for long. And Gene agrees with that, which I guess he meant to say the other way, that he would be the champion for a long time. In fact, he wouldn't lose the title in that twin referee business until Orndorff had left the territory after a very, very long run. Now, Roddy Piper is standing behind them, and you know he's not just going to stand back there quietly and twiddle his thumb. So we're going to hear a little bit from him. But I should mention as well, Orndorff was facing away from the camera for the entire time that he was talking. So the back of his robe saying Orndorff was facing. So it was fine, but I was like, what the hell's going on here, Mr. Wonderful? What are you, some kind of priest from the pre-Vatican II Catholic Church where you're doing the mass with your back to the congregation? Anyway, here's Piper.
This is what we've got. We've got a brand new world champion, Hulk Hogan, coming out here with these nice silk slacks, the hair dyed, looking like the village people. Now he's won the world's heavyweight title, sitting back, drinking Don Perignon, watching Boy George on television. The guy is taking it easy because he's got the world by the short hairs, but brother, we ain't doing that. We coming from a gym that there ain't nothing like. We're coming from mean meat, brother. Well, we're coming at you as head on. We ain't playing no games.
Yeah, with how manic Piper is, the only person who was even remotely like him in the New York territory prior to this that I can think of is Captain Lou Albano, who had been there for a really long time. So you knew that the whole Piper act was definitely going to play in New York for, well, the next 3 years and change is what he would be there. And Up next, we have Tito Santana. And as we learned on the November 88 show, Tito might not be the best promo when he's out there by himself, but I guess in this case, it's not an event center thing where he's just talking directly into the camera. He does have Gene Okerlund to play off of.
And you know, I've had time to review that film. I still don't understand why that referee called that match. After the match was over, I tried to talk to the referee. I wanted an explanation, but he wouldn't give it to me. Don Morocco, I said it before. You're tired. You've had a rough schedule. Tito Santana's after your track, brother, and I had you beat there at the Garden. Cobarde, te garantizo. Esta vez no te me escapas. Enfrente la gente, los latinos. Te ganaría aquí en el Garden. Pagarás, cobarde. Arriba.
You know I don't speak Spanish. In English, please.
Well, I think I can understand why Tito would address the audience in Spanish, because there's a significant population in New York City who you want to come to the show, and Tito, being a Spanish speaker, can appeal to that audience, I think, in ways that maybe even Pedro Morales couldn't at that point, being a much more exciting wrestler for the decade of the 1980s. And up next, I mean, apparently this is just interview after interview after interview. We get the masked superstar who it has a jacket on that has a picture of himself that for a split second, I actually thought it was another person that was like a mini-me dressed up as him. Like, oh, apparently the masked superstar is taken to dressing up Vern Troyer like himself to come out with him for all of his promos.
All right, come on in, masked superstar, if you will. Sign of the next big card, Andre the Giant, your opponent, Monday night, February the 20th, Madison Square Garden.
Well, what do you say about an individual of his size and strength? You don't come out here and make a fool out of yourself and say you're going to tear him apart. You're going to do this and you're going to do that. I've got to use my brains. I've got to go into this match with some strategy. And I have developed it, Andre. I know that there are thousands and thousands of people in that big arena, that Madison Square Garden arena, that would love to see you attempt to take this mask from my head. Well, that's part of my strategy, because when you're going after it, when you're tugging and pulling and trying to rip this mask from my head, I've got two free hands that take you down to size.
That is a lucid, intelligent, well-thought-out objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Overruled.
It actually is a well-thought-out strategy. I mean, it didn't work. I mean, you're facing Andre the Giant in Madison Square Garden, so it's really not going to happen for you. In fact, it would be the masked superstar's last appearance in Madison Square Garden in that gimmick. Of course, Bill Eadie would be back several years later as one of the machines, and of course, one of the other machines is Giant Machine, who very rarely wrestled, Andre did, under the mask. And Andre actually comes in the other side when the masked superstar walks off, so they're clearly standing close to each other, perhaps exposing the business. However, I will give the opposing argument to that, which is these guys are total pros, and they are there to draw money. And if you draw money, your paycheck will be more for the MSG show. That is why they're able to keep themselves in check for that period where they're just doing the interviews for it. So Andre, being, you know, of the size that he is, completely unrivaled at this point in time, because John Studd's really not around all that much in early 84. We don't really see him again until the spring and summer. Andre is the kind of guy, he can kind of walk and talk and do whatever he wants and do what he says. Kind of like what Angelo Mosca used to say, Andre could actually do that.
Gene, I wrestled a guy many times, and this time I got a chance to go against a masked superstar for the first time. So you say, I maybe will try to get his mask off, but the first thing I want to do, I want to still be undefeated. Maybe if I go for your mask, I got to do it after I go to beat you right in the middle of the ring, in the ring for the count to three. Because my superstar may go out on his throw, but you're in trouble with me too, because you never wrestling with me in single match before, but you're going to see what it is to wrestling against a giant.
And the crazy thing is, that's exactly what he did. He beat the masked superstar 1-2-3 in the middle of the ring, and then went for the mask. Now, masked superstar ended up getting away in this final match at Madison Square Garden, but it's not exactly what Andre is in it for. He just wants to remain undefeated, and he's content to be the giant, just like that other promo that he did for All American Wrestling. That he was not going to be challenging for the world title. He's perfectly content in the role within the World Wrestling Federation that he is occupying at that moment.
Tonight I have two special announcements I'm very pleased to make. Victory Magazine, which is the only sanctioned publication of the World Wrestling Federation, is changing its name.
This decision best reflects the magazine's purpose as the only sanctioned body, the World Wrestling Federation. Its new title, the new title of the magazine, changing from Victory Magazine to the World Wrestling Federation Magazine. The other important announcement is a new article that will be a regularly appearing in the magazine. The new article will be Piper's Pit. And with me tonight is Roddy Piper, who is the author of the new article. And I'm delighted to have him with me this evening. Roddy?
Let me have this for a second here.
I can't help but think that Roddy Piper is on a mission of mercy, like the Alec Baldwin character in Glengarry Glen Ross. He was sent here by Mitch and Murray to save us from Robert DeBoard, whose voice you heard there hosting. It was the last Victory Corner or the first Piper's Pit. I don't know what accounting method you're going to use for this, but Robert DeBoard, known in some circles as Joe Nerdlinger. I mean, if you just look at the guy, you would swear that, oh, the man's name is clearly Joe Nerdlinger. He's a magazine editor for Victory Magazine and later WWF Magazine. So it gives him one thing in common with Vince Russo. However, with Vince Russo, there are people who inexplicably like him a lot, even in the year 2019, and there are people who dislike him greatly. See, the difference between that and Robert DeBoard, nobody cares about Robert DeBoard. Like, I feel like I'm the only person who ever talks about this guy, and I don't know why the hell I care. Now, he leaves, you never see him on TV again. I guess there's a couple of All-Americans at the beginning of February residual Victory Corner episodes that carried over. It doesn't really matter, because DeBoard, much like Roddy Piper, would go on to pursue a movie career where he would join the Lambda Lambda Lambdas in the 1984 feature film Revenge of the Nerds. I don't know that for a fact. His name doesn't show up in IMDb. I'm just assuming, looking at him, he would definitely be at home in the Tri-Lambdas. Now, I know that they did a lot of things in that movie, and it maybe doesn't hold up well, but trust me, he's got to be in the background somewhere. I'm going to probably need to rewatch that at some point. But yes, the announcement now, Roddy Piper is writing an article in the magazine, which he seems to have kind of screwed up. Like, no, he's going to be hosting this segment on Championship Wrestling and on All-Star for a while. So much of 84, Piper is doing double duty. But I love it. He's like Stan Gable. He just comes in and takes charge. But unlike Ted McGinley, who played Stan in Revenge of the Nerds, Roddy Piper, not the kind of guy who would become, you know, the patron saint of jumping the shark, as Mr. McGinley did for his appearances on many shows. Although I think he gets a bad rap on Married with Children, although I do believe that the Steve episodes were better, the early ones. I've kind of changed my view on that later in life. So, right, here we go. Early Roddy Piper, he's establishing himself to this audience. I mean, we heard a little bit from him earlier, but what is this first Piper's Pit? What does it sound like?
I am the originator of Piper's Pit, and I'd like to explain why, especially to you. You have been doing a tremendous job, and with a few flaws, and I'm trying to be political when I say this, but when you are interviewing some of the people that come out, possibly they intimidate you, but you, with them, you're the questions, the way it's kind of how can I say that? You're being kind of stupid.
No, wait a minute.
This is my show now. You just wait a minute. I'll give you an example. I see Ivan Putski up there in the ring singing some kind of Polish song. I would rather listen to Lassie Barnes than Ivan Putski sing up here. He comes back here, and you, like a geek, you sit there, and you put him, you say, Ivan, you're such a wonderful man. You got Tony Atlas, and you get Rocky Johnson out here, and they're sitting here flexing, pretending they're wonderful. They're going to the gym, and they're telling you how great they are, and you sometimes don't have the guts enough to say to them what really is happening. Hulk Hogan is coming out here. He's got a whole... No, wait a second.
According to this magazine...
I'll tell you what I'll bring to this magazine. This is the heat of seat right there. What I'm telling you is this. I will not pull no punches. This is Piper's Corner. Let me tell you something. I will ask questions you don't have guts enough to. I will ask questions only I got guts enough to. It's as simple as this. When RP talks, brother, people listen. That's all I got to say.
For those of us who have seen the episodes of Victory Corner that aired in late 83 and into 84, Piper's critiques, I think, are pretty fair. You know, he was a little bit intimidated, like he didn't know how to be on television. I mean, just doing that announcement there at the end, it's as if he did not get better at all. And Piper kind of saves this from one aspect. I know he's going to run down various members of the roster, and I know that this is only because of that one thing that occurred in 1990. I just love it when Roddy Piper says Tony Atlas.
That's Tony Atlas.
You got Tony Atlas.
Tony Atlas.
That's Tony Atlas. Don't Saba Simba. That's Tony Atlas. It's just something. The way Piper says that name will always tickle me in the right way. So Robert DeBoard, this is his final Victory Corner in front of the crowd in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I'm sure there's not a dry eye in the house. But hilariously, this is how he wraps up.
I'll be looking forward to his articles in the new
Joe McHugh just starts talking over him mid-sentence. I mean, what a goodbye that is for Robert DeBoard. It just entirely fitting the way he goes out, just being interrupted by an 80-something-year-old guy in the ring because a cue got missed. Oh, Robert DeBoard, I wish I knew how to quit you.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the Information Purification Collectors. We have created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology, where each worker may bloom, secure from the pests, obeying contradictory reports. Unification of the Force is more powerful a weapon than any fleet or army on Earth. We are one people. One will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
I'm not sure if the Macintosh ad that aired during Super Bowl 18 is the greatest commercial of all time, but it's certainly the greatest Super Bowl commercial of all time. I mean, we devolved years later into just monkeys clapping and like, look at how we pissed away 2.5 million. That commercial is smart, it's cinematic, it makes a literary reference to Orwell, and it puts over the product very simply at the end, like, oh yeah, in 2 days, this new computer Macintosh is going to be coming out. And things aren't going to be like in Orwell's 1984, because IBM computers maybe weren't making the kind of progress you would expect from the computing world, and Macintosh kind of changed the game going forward for Apple. Now, their success wouldn't, you know, carry over forever. They'd have some bumps in the road, but hey, that's how it goes in the tech world, quite frankly. So up next, we have the return of Greg the Hammer Valentine, and he gets the returning to this arena after a long absence. That's when you know somebody is important that's been away for a while. Well, actually, sometimes McHugh would say that for actually, for the enhancement guys, McHugh would say making his first appearance in this arena, and it would be like some jabron. But we have the ultimate enhancement talent on the other side, Frankie Williams, who would go on to have a much more famous moment on Piper's Pit in 1984, a couple months later. And this is pretty much the last year that you'd see him in the WWF. Valentine is a very interesting case here, making his return, because he's literally challenging Dick Slater for the United States title in Jim Crockett Promotions 2 days before this. So you think, okay, well, now he's in the WWF for good. Well, you would be wrong, because Valentine is doing that thing where he's overlapping girlfriends. Yes, he hasn't quite broken up with his last girlfriend, but he's already started dating his next girlfriend, the WWF, which is where he's going to be for the long term. He does two more sets of tapings while still working in Jim Crockett Promotions. It's pretty crazy when you think about how nuts WWF would be about exclusivity going forward, not going to be sharing anybody with any other territories. But he's only working the television tapings in January, February, and in March. And he's only working the Allentown tapings. So none of this Hamburg All-Star tapings for Valentine. Apparently, he must be a vegetarian. He's averse to Hamburg. But anyway, So late March, he's in for good, and not so much as a challenger for Hulk Hogan, although he did have a handful of matches. I'm not sure how crazy Hogan was in working with Valentine, kind of, you know, your stiff NWA style worker, although Hogan was a little bit more gritty in 84 and 85. He's more of an IC foil going forward in that Intercontinental division, which is definitely where he would shine for the next year, year and a half, 2 years. 84, WWF is just loading up on the heel side. Piper, Orndorff, Dr. D, Valentine, Bob Orton, another guy who was splitting time for a little while between WWF and Jim Crockett Promotions. He was kind of splitting time between New York and the Carolinas. So you got all these top heels coming in. So from that perspective, going back to what I was saying earlier about Tito, and, well, does it make sense to have the IC champion be a babyface when the world champion is a babyface? It does if all you're doing is bringing in these heels as challengers and you're a little bit maybe weak on the babyface side. The thing I like about Valentine is that he carries a sort of NWA oeuvre even when he's in the WWF, so he makes him kind of stand out from some of the other guys who kind of, you know, folded into what the WWF was looking for. Valentine would still kind of stand out. He wasn't all about gimmicks, at least until he dyed his hair a few years later. It's just crazy how he was in two places at once in the first quarter of 1984. It's just a quick takedown, Russian leg sweep. Although, I guess Virgil saw that and said, I'm going to make that my finisher in a few years. So, some more mat stuff and Indian deathlock. So, working the leg, Valentine is to set up for the figure four. And also, working the thigh. You don't see a lot of good thigh work in pro wrestling. I know, I watch a lot of squash matches. Like, go to work on the thigh, you don't really see that as much. The Valentine suplex that I also love so much, where he kind of tosses the guy with one arm. Figure four quickly finishes. He actually had, in that 1984 period where he's working in the two places and only worked the TV tapings for the WWF, he worked Frankie Williams twice, so apparently he must have enjoyed this a lot, because when he came back in March, he did it all over again. And it is the figure four that finishes it off, which Vince says he's perfected like no other wrestler in history. So apparently, I'm going to take that as an indirect diss of Ric Flair by Vince McMahon, who probably isn't even really thinking of him all that much, because he knows that the Nature Boy isn't one of those guys that's going to come over, since, you know, he's the NWA champion. You had the Starrcade 83 thing just happen. Also, maybe a mild diss of Buddy Rogers, using the figure four, since Buddy kind of disappeared on him late in 83. Although, I don't know how pissed Vince might have stayed with all that, but who knows? I'm never going to get fully into Vince McMahon's head on certain things, and quite honestly, that's probably for the best.
We'll be back with Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff, facing Tony Garea.
Why, thank you, Vince. I'm glad somebody else is introducing the matches for a change. And yes, it is Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff alongside Rowdy Roddy Piper taking on the great Tony Garea. Now, there's some Paula chants from the crowd, because that was the easy way that Mr. Wonderful would get heat back in the day. It's very early in his WWF run, very heavy on the Paula chants. A lot of people doing that thing where it's a group of five and they each hold up one letter. That seems to be something that is lost in today's era. I mean, you don't see it that often. Maybe it goes back to that Seinfeld where they all went shirtless and had to spell out devils. It doesn't seem like you see as much of it these days. Although I remember the Go Joes at Bruins games, but, you know, once Joe Thornton went away, that kind of went the way of the dodo. Now, speaking of Bruins games, I have a friend that I go to those games with. He's 59 years old. He's been a season ticket holder since 1986. He loves him, the Boston Bruins. He's lost two toes to diabetes, but he still goes to pretty much every game over the course of the season. But the notable thing about him, and he showed no particular love for wrestling in the first, I don't know, 13, 15 years that I knew him. Apparently, he loves him some Tony Garea like nobody else. Which is strange, because being Italian and being from Boston, you would think that Bruno Sammartino would be his guy. Boston, very much a Bruno town, certainly preferred over Backlund, but he loved Tony Garea for whatever reason. Just the other day, at the preseason game against the Blackhawks, he turned to me, he said, Tony Garea, five-time champion. And he was doing that thing without knowing the Booker T bit, which I thought was kind of funny because I don't think he would know who Booker T is. Clearly, he'll never get over Game 7 against St. Louis in terms of talking to him. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago when it was Tony Garea's 73rd birthday, I actually sent him a text message, and he was very excited. I sent a picture of Tony Garea letting him know, hey, it's your boy's 73rd birthday today. And, you know, of course, you get the great coif of hair on top of his head. And he writes back, what a legend, my man. He lives in Hampton, Connecticut, and he was a five-time champion. Let's see our choking Bruins team do that. Ha, ha, ha. See you next Saturday. He can never let it go that they lost in the playoffs. Apparently I won't, but I've just decided to move on at least a little bit publicly. So Orndorff dominates very early in the corner here because Garea as a single at this point in his career, it's not really going any place for him. He's definitely in that. He's like Coco Beware, except not really, you know, amping up the crowd in any sort of way. I mean, I love that head of hair and all, but, you know, let's be serious here. But Garea, after Orndorff misses a charge, he wisely works the shoulder that hit the post. And Orndorff comes back with a body slam, but then misses an elbow. So Garea takes this opportunity to grab a side headlock. So you know what that means. Paul Orndorff going to counter with the back suplex. He's going to dump Tony Garea on the back of his head. He's going to let all Japan know that, you know, what they missed out on, because Orndorff had only ever worked New Japan previously. And he's in the New Japan-affiliated American promotion. Now, Gene Okerlund on color commentary is, again, not a huge fan of his work there, but there's a lot of weirdness that comes out. Like, even in the year 1984, I find it very, very peculiar that he's talking about getting a friggin' telegram.
By the way, Vince McMahon, we talk about the ever-changing faces in the World Wrestling Federation. I've just got to read this telegram just arriving at our broadcast table from former world champion, the great Bob Backlund. Here it is. Hulk Hogan, congratulations on your great victory. The belt is back in the USA where it belongs. Sincerely, Bob Backlund.
Well, Mr. Backlund, without a doubt, one of the all-time great world... Oh, no, look at that! Oh!
I let that run because it's so funny. Bob Backlund sent a telegram to the announce table at the Allentown tapings. Just the notion of doing that in 1984, when who was sending telegrams even then? And then also sending it to the announce table. I don't know. Backlund's been there for a while. They were in Allentown for pretty much his entire reign as champion. So, all right, maybe I should put that aside. But it's they read the telegram, and then Vince is saying, he's one of the all-time greats, and then just cuts off mid-sentence before he finishes his thought by what's going on in the ring. It's a fitting goodbye to Bob Backlund, even though he's going to be around for another 7 months and be on TV only every so often. So the comeback by Tony Garea in this match is actually cut off fairly quickly as a knee to the back of the head finishes off Mr. Garea by Mr. Wonderful off the second rope. So not something you'd see Orndorff do very often, but he's not going to beat Garea with the pile drivers. He's accorded that level of respect. And as they cut to the crowd shot after the match, there's actually a group of Roddy Piper fans in there, which for 1984, it's a dot matrix printer banner that just says Rowdy Roddy Piper. That's all you had to do back in the day. If you had one of those fancy, you know, from an Apple computer, I guess, for just printed out on a dot matrix. I had one of them, an Apple IIgs, I guess, a little bit later in the 80s. But, man, those Philadelphia-based smarks making their way up to Allentown for the tapings. No wonder why they had to move it to Poughkeepsie in the middle of the year.
You know something, Gene? Never before have I seen 30,000 people with such electricity in their bones like they were in Madison Square Garden.
You electrified them, Hulk.
Oh, man, you know, my blood turned to ice-cold water running up through my veins. And the thing is, now I've got this Mr. Wonderful in the ring. But you know something? Have you ever got down on all fours and butted heads with a Sherman tank? Have you ever... arm wrestling a rhinoceros, or have you ever put a hammerlock on a polar bear and made him spin up ice cubes? Well, you know something? I've done that, Mean Gene. And Mr. Wonderful, you better have it all together when you get in the ring with a Hulkster.
I know we didn't hear from him earlier. I guess maybe you plant Hogan in this promo spot so he kind of stands out and he's not just one in a group of four. So luckily, he has the belt on right side up because he doesn't have that idiot referee putting it on for him. 84 Hogan, certainly a different guy in the ring. It might owe to the fact that when he wins the title, he's only 30 years old, exactly. You don't get the wear and tear. He didn't have the wear and tear on his body that he would suffer over the next several years working a lot more dates as the world champion. So he kind of had a more gritty style. And then also, his promos, I've always said, the dividing line for him is WrestleMania 3, March of 1987. Everything before that is a little bit more human and a little bit less cartoony. It's almost like a more manic style. He comes across as more human, and I think it goes into why he was able to connect so well with the people.
You got to watch out for this man, Roddy Piper, by his side, certain to be in his corner on the 20th.
That's right, Mean Gene. I have already got this man's MO. I've got one eye on the corner, but the thing that gets me off so much, I watch this Orndorff float around the arenas, float around the interview desk, and caress his body. Tell everybody how wonderful he is. What I'm going to do with this man, it'll be like squashing a flower, like squashing a grape, Mean Gene. I can't wait to make Hulkamania run wild.
Well, actually, Piper's real MO was never losing to Hogan cleanly, but that feud does not start up in earnest. They don't even have their first match with each other until October of that year, and I believe it was in the Boston Garden, of all places. So you kind of got to postpone that, push it down the road. It's not quite ready yet. Hogan could face a variety of opponents leading up to that point, and then it's perfectly timed. You can do it leading into the first WrestleMania, the war to settle the score, all that stuff. Even if you don't have the singles match at WrestleMania, what they did with Mr. T, undoubtedly more effective in bringing eyeballs to the product.
This is the moment when you need the quick response and smooth acceleration that comes from Exxon unleaded regular gasoline. It has higher octane than most other unleaded regulars to help free your engine from knocking and pinging. And for even more octane, try Exxon Extra Unleaded. When the moment demands performance, get Exxon. Quality you can count on.
I don't know about you, but I've never once decided to go to a gas station based on a commercial I saw on TV. It's if I happen to be low on gas and I'm going past the gas station, or if it's cleaner than some of the other ones, you know, it doesn't look dingy, doesn't look like it's gonna, you know, be bad gas to put in the car, for lack of a better term. I don't know. What is the point of that Exxon commercial? I mean, you really don't actually see those anymore. I mean, does Speedway do ads? I mean, they took over all the Hess stations where I live not that long ago. So, I don't know. Retail gas seems to have been something that's faded into the background. If you're wondering why I'm talking about that, coming up next, we got the debut of B. Brian Blair in the World Wrestling Federation, and I just wrote UGH next to his name, taking on Charlie Fulton. And yes, he's actually known as B. Brian Blair. I always thought that that was because it was the Killer Bees, and he just added on an extra B because it was, you know, one thing. Or like the Homer Simpson, welcome to the BBBQ.
Come to Homer's BBBQ. The extra B is for BYOBB.
What's that extra B for?
That's a typo.
That episode, Lisa the Vegetarian, is interesting for two reasons. Number one, Paul and Linda McCartney are actually, the drawings of them were, they actually gave them color to their eyes, brown for Paul and blue for Linda McCartney. I literally never noticed that until I'm reading the IMDb trivia, but I did know that Paul and Linda McCartney agreed to do the episode on the condition that Lisa remain a vegetarian for the remainder of The Simpsons. Now, I don't know if there was something in season 28. There are so many episodes I can't remember, but Lisa, to my knowledge, has actually remained a vegetarian. It's a lot better than talking about a Brian Blair match against Charlie Fulton. And by the way, I would have put Fulton over here. I know I'm not the greatest booker in the world, but I would have put Fulton over clean, probably about 30 seconds. And you're probably saying, Pete, why do you have it out for Brian Blair? Well, I'll tell you. There are a lot of different reasons, but I'll just give you the simplest one. He bores me. When I did my 1984 rewatch in the summer of 2016, he would turn up on TV fairly frequently. He's gone by the end of the summer when you get another influx of people. So he goes away pretty quickly, but then eventually comes back. I mean, when I watched this episode on the airplane on the way to Alaska last week, I was so bored by this match, I fell asleep. I mean, let's think about that for a second. We're talking like a 4-minute quick match, and I fell, all right, let's say half asleep. I didn't fall full, but you're so boring that you fall asleep during his squash matches. They start out with a handshake, which, because apparently this is 2002 Ring of Honor. I mean, this is why I've decided to become more of a Bad News Brown tribute podcast, because he's actually interesting, and I enjoy talking about him, and I have no shortage of angles to come up with, talk about Bad News Brown, Bad News Allen, what have you. But Brian Blair, for God's sakes, okay, so he works the mat a little bit, a drop toe hold off an Irish whip, some hammer locks on the mat. I mean, let me tell you how boring Brian Blair is. There are two Howard Finkel reads during this match. You know, the one where he tells you, come on down to West Islip High School? He did two of them during this match. I mean, that never happens. But, oh, Brian Blair match, something historic like that's bound to happen. You get a clean break in the corner, but Fulton grabs a side headlock on the mat now, but we get a back suplex by Blair. And, by the way, I'm not the only person who has it out for him, because the crowd just does not care about him in Allentown. They really want him to go away. I mean, Okerlund, for his part, he's doing his best to try and put this crap over, but nah.
This Blair has got fantastic technique. I'm especially impressed with the way he works his feet and legs, Vince McMahon.
I like the way he uses his feet and legs. Brian Blair, everybody, come on down to the arena and pay money to see him wrestle. And now we get the Brian Blair finishing move from 1984. Are you ready for this? It's an Irish whip into an abdominal stretch, which he then takes down Charlie Fulton into a roll-up. Let's just say, I do not care for this man's work. Sometimes I can't remember, like, things from one episode to another. I mean, I'm now down 136 of these, plus, you know, assorted specials. But this is the one where I took a Brian Blair match, carefully placed it out, laid it out for everybody to see, pulled down my pants, spread my butt cheeks so that, you know, there was absolutely no mistake. It took a giant dump on B. Brian Blair in 1984.
This what I am really, really looking forward to. Andre the Giant, Tito Santana as a team right here on this very television program to meet Matt Superstar and, of course, his partner, Mr. Fuji. It is going to be something else indeed.
You have no idea how right you are, Mean Gene, because it was literally something else because of Mr. Fuji not wanting to tag with anybody but Tiger Chung Lee. I mean, that is some serious loyalty there. And you talk about cross-double, or Mr. Fuji, or when he meant to say double cross in the show a couple weeks ago. Like, he's so loyal to Tiger Chung Lee. You have to respect that. And then, of course, they would break up 6 months later. Anyway, the match would actually end up being Andre the Giant and Tito Santana defeating Butcher Vachon and Rene Goulet, substituting for the mass superstar Mr. Fuji, apparently not seeing eye to eye. But it goes into my all roads lead back to the 1988 Survivor Series in my view of the wrestling world, because you got mass superstar Mr. Fuji. They had their split at the 88 Survivor Series with Demolition Fuji, which I covered in the show 2 weeks ago. But Andre and Tito Santana were on opposite sides in that Survivor Series, with one of my favorite spots in professional wrestling history. Tito Santana trying to do a sunset flip on 1988 Andre the Giant, who just sits on him. It's the funniest goddamn thing ever, and I love it so much. But then again, I love everything about the 88 Survivor Series, pretty much. And you know what? That is going to be it for WWF Championship Wrestling from January 28, 1984.
On October 3rd, he asked me what day it was.
It's October 3rd.
Hey, I figured I would drop that in, considering this show is dropping on October 3rd, which is Mean Girls Day. It's probably going to show up on cable, even though it probably shows up on cable October 1st, 2nd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th. It's on like every single day. It's It's kind of like what Roadhouse was 15 years ago. The torch has been passed. I'll tell you who's not a mean girl, though, and that is Jennifer Smith of the Jenny Position podcast feed. I was on, we actually recorded a episode of Freak Out Drive-In coming soon, which you're going to hear me like you've never heard me before, talking about subjects that I do not delve into on this podcast. So be on the lookout for that. She has a new podcast feed, the Jenny Position, and I encourage you to subscribe on iTunes, a wide variety of great material over there. Now, in other podcasts as well, the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they talk WrestleMania 3. What if Andre couldn't go? Ah, that question. What would it have been, Orndorff and Hogan yet again, like it was at the big event? Personally, Kamala was there too. And Kamala was maybe a little bit fresher than Orndorff would have been as an opponent. Now, I mean, they would have been completely screwed if Andre shows up the day of, is like, yeah, I can't do it, considering the build that they did. So thank God that that did not happen. And on the wrestling podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Edie McClurg, I mean, Brian Fury, owner of Chaotic Wrestling, they talk about Valerie Harper, a.k.a. Brian Malonis, bleeding out at the Ring of Honor pay-per-view Death Before Dishonor in Las Vegas. A shocking scene to those who knew him. But tune into that podcast, for Mike Crockett said something very important. And I have my fun with Mike on this show. But he said something that I agree with it 20,000%. I'm going to go way over the 150% that the guy, the athletic director of my high school, used to do. 20,000%. Like, why is everybody so all over Matt Taven for Ring of Honor? Oh, the promotion went downhill because Matt Taven was the world title. Like, people hate him because he's a heel. That is what it is. I mean, give me a break. I don't quite understand it.
Look at this, everyone. 12 dead snakes. I'm sick of you people. You're nothing but a pack of fickle mush heads.
He's right.
Amen. I'm on Team Taven. I know this might not be as controversial as me being on Team Leno, but hey, that's the way I feel. And on the sportscasters with my good pal Steve Bennett, he's got Jeff Perlman, one of my favorite recurring guests on the sportscasters, and also Albert Chen is on the program as well. Steve's going to be heading down to New Orleans to see his Saints play against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers this weekend. And that reminds me, it's time for some Vinny Vegas Corner. One and two last week, 7-5 on the season. That's not going to deliver the mail, and I hope I do a better job this week. Let's go for a perfect 3-0. And what I'm going to look for is for the dogs to rise in this one. I'm looking at two home underdogs in particular. I'm going to start out in Pittsburgh. Steelers taking on the Baltimore Ravens. One of the best football rivalries in this century. I'm not sure it's number one, but I think it's kind of been in the top five for this entire 20 years since the year 2000, because both teams are always very good. They play very close games. The joke is that every game between the two teams ends up some form of 17-14, 20-17, some sort of three-point game. And seeing the Steelers getting 3.5 points at home, even without Ben Roethlisberger, I mean, you know, there's a certain maybe when a quarterback gets hurt, maybe they can have a dead cat bounce. I think the Steelers are a little bit better than even that. So them getting 3.5 against the Ravens, who are now at 2-2, and probably, I don't want to say they're desperately in need of a win, but the Steelers are in position to put themselves right back in the hunt in the, I want to call it the AFC Central, but it's been the AFC North, Pete, for the last 17 years. So I'm going to start with Pittsburgh getting 3.5 against the Baltimore Ravens. And even though I said I wasn't going to do this anymore, this is because Eli was quarterback, Eli Manning. Now, we got Daniel Jones, quarterback of the New York Giants, at home against Minnesota Vikings. Giants are getting 5 in that one. And all I got to hope for in this game is that the Giants score first, because the Vikings just don't seem to have any sort of ability to come from behind, which is a pretty sad statement considering their quarterback, Kirk Cousins, makes approximately $48.8 million a year. I don't know the exact cap figure, but it's not like he's an elite quarterback in the National Football League. So I like the Giants getting 5 in that one at home. And then finally, on Monday Night Football, a rather strange Monday Night Football matchup. The Browns are in San Francisco to take on the undefeated 49ers coming off a bye week. And I'm not sure why. I was looking through for underdogs, and the Browns getting 3.5 here. I mean, I see this as a 3-point game, so maybe I'm not dealing with the greatest of margins, but the Browns have a chance to actually go into first place in the AFC North if my other projection of the Baltimore-Pittsburgh game is correct. I'm not saying they're going to win the game outright, but getting 3.5, I feel like there might be a little bit of an overlay there, given that the Browns have played better on the road this year, or so it seems, blowing Baltimore out in the fourth quarter last week. So I like Cleveland getting 3.5 at San Francisco. So that, and Pittsburgh getting 3.5 against Baltimore, and Giants getting 5 at home against Minnesota for Vinny Vegas Corner. Now, I don't have a specific show planned for next week, in part because there's been a lot of channels popping up on YouTube recently that used to be there, and some of them are under different names, and don't tell anybody about this, because it's a really joyous time to be watching wrestling on YouTube. So, something may come up. It might be time to check on Grandpa Bill Watts again. And I hope I'll be able to do enough research, because starting a new job, you know, it's a bit of a steep learning curve in the first few weeks, and it's something where, for my own sake, for my own pride, I want to get caught up, you know, faster than they expect me to. So it's something that's going to be a challenge for me going forward these next couple of weeks, and hopefully the podcast does not suffer for it. I don't want to have to take a week off. I like to release something every Thursday, but we shall see going forward. Now, you know, if I did have to miss a week, I would do some sort of make good to you, my valued listener. And please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and iTunes and all that good stuff for Greetings from Allentown. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside, and it also provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. And do likewise for the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well. 5 stars for me and for all the shows on this network. Again, I thank you so much for listening, and tune in next Thursday? Yeah. Thursday's the day I do this, yes, for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
He's a big dummy.
Yeah,
he's losing his hair. He bleaches it. He does this. He does that. He's the new champion, right?